All right, I'm pleased to welcome back to the Shilling Show, regular guest here, David Murata, the president of Murata Wealth Management, and continuing a series that's been very popular with listeners, and we've got these posted up online as well. You can check it out at shillingshow.com. Looking backward on socialism, no such thing as self-sufficiency. David, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so let's briefly recall this book for people who have not heard our previous conversations.
Yeah, this series is based on a book written in 1888, which some people might think is, why are you talking about a book written in 1888? Mm-hmm. But I would venture to say that this is probably the most influential book published in the past 250 years, meaning that it's had the greatest influence on world history, world wars, and all socialist thought in the United States and basically around the world. So it's interesting to see this book. It was one of the most popular books of its day, and it had a great political impact and, in fact, moved countries and moved armies. So the most interesting thing about it is that most of the socialist thought of today is actually expressed clearer in this book sometimes than it is in other comments. And by that, we can learn a great deal by looking at this book, the things that it sets forth, and then the modern echoes that have come for the last 120 years, 140 years.
So one of the premises, and we're hearing this in Charlottesville, you know, we've got a Democrat socialist running and other Democrats who are certainly socialists, so they're not saying that, is that government collectivism is responsible for national and personal success. This is the basis of everything. And it doesn't make any sense to me, because if that was the case, the government should just confiscate everything from us and just think how great our lives would be.
Yeah, and that's certainly the idea and the goal. It's certainly the idea in this book. In the book, a Bostonian man falls into a deep trance, and he awakens 113 years later in the year 2000 to find that the United States has done exactly that, and now he lives in a socialist utopia. There's an interesting place where the main character is talking to Dr. Leet. He's kind of the tour guide of the book to explain how the United States came to some such a blessed socialist utopia. Mm-hmm. And the main character makes a comment about charity for those who are incapable of self-support, because they receive the same income as everyone else. And Dr. Leet takes umbrage with that, and he says, and this will echo every modern version of this as well, "Who is capable of self-support?" he demanded. "There's no such thing in a civilized society as self-support. In a state of society so barbarous as to not even know family cooperation, each individual may possibly support himself, though even then for only part of his life. But from the moment all men begin to live and constitute even the rudest sort of society, self-support becomes impossible. As men grow more civilized, the subdivision of occupations and services carried out, a complex mutual dependence becomes the universal rule. Every man, however solitary may seem his occupation, is a member of a vast industrial partnership as large as the nation, as large as humanity." And then the money line, "As necessity of mutual dependence should imply the duty and guarantee of mutual support."
So this is interesting. As I was reading through the materials you sent me to prepare for today, David, one of the things that struck me was this kind of concept of universal basic income that's starting to come to America now. They're trying it in one of the cities in California. I think it may be Stockton, where the government's just going to give everybody money. They're just going to give you money. And it sounded a lot like what they were talking about this equalization, no matter what you're doing. And I guess even if you're sitting on your butt doing nothing, you're going to get money.
Yeah. And in the book, it's not just a basic income. Mm-hmm. It's an income that's universal. So whether you work really hard or you do no work at all or you're incapable of work, you get the same amount of money. It's interesting. If people think this is going to help people, they should look at zoo animals who receive food and don't have to do anything for anything that they do. Turns out zoo animals die very young. A certain amount of stress and purpose in life is necessary for a healthy life. And this idea of being self-sufficient, for hunting for yourself, is something they have to actually introduce into zoo animals' lives just to keep them healthy. So they actually have to stress them. So we're not even cruel enough to treat zoo animals these days by giving them a basic income of food and letting them go on their way.
And we've seen these signs in the wild before, warning people not to feed the wild animals for exactly the same purpose.
Exactly.
So what is the disconnect between human nature and people making policy? Because they seem to get it on animals, but not on people.
Yeah, it is amazing. We should have a similar sign that says, you know, government handouts are not healthy for people.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea of self-sufficiency is actually an important idea. There's really sort of two different approaches. One is to say, well, you know, you need government and you need all these government handouts in order to run your lives. You need all of this infrastructure and social services and stuff. But two, anyone who's been trained even moderately in economics, there's an alternate way of viewing the world, and that is from Adam Smith. Adam Smith suggests that in a free market, lots of people acting in their own self-interest can provide you with things that you might need, mm-hmm. and yet they do it without any obligation either to you or for or from you. So this idea of free commerce means that lots of people can specialize and they can do it in a way that maintains their freedom, and through voluntary transactions, both sides can be made better with no obligations. And that just is a much freer and better way to live than to focus on what has government done for you, and therefore what are you obligated to do for government, in a way that is kind of a cyclical way. That is, first government mandates, they're the only ones who are going to provide this good, and they're mm-hmm. going to give it to you whether you like it or not. And then they turn around and say, okay, so now that you've received that, even though you didn't ask for it, now we're going to obligate you to give back a huge chunk of whatever you have for the common good. And that kind of transaction is really a kind of transaction that's just against freedom. It just is an oppressive government enforcing their will. And you're right. In a sense, you know, it's just a matter of how enslaved you are, not are you enslaved or not.
We've got about a minute, but all this kind of reminds me of the gig economy and some of these new startups like Uber and Lyft and Airbnb. And as soon as they get up and thriving, the government comes down with the big hammer and tries to whack them down or make them conform or say that they're being unfair to other people who are subject to government control.
Yeah, one way of saying it is that mankind yearns to be free mm-hmm. and government yearns for them not to be free. and it's really why a smaller government is something that anyone who is oppressed by those kinds of regulations yearns for, because we yearn to be free, we yearn to be left alone, we yearn to not have the burdens of things that we think are either stupid or onerous put upon us.
977-1070 is the phone number. David Morata is our guest, and we're continuing this series, and we've had a number of these programs, and we will have a lot more because there's a lot of material in the book. But today's topic is looking backward on socialism. No such thing as self-sufficiency. Is that contention true? We'll come back on the other side and go to some of the relevant questions here. And we welcome you, 434-977-1070. If you have comments, questions, challenges for the guest or the host, we'd love for you to call in. You can get in line right now, and we can take your calls on the other side of news and weather. Samantha stands by. It's 434-977-1070. Shilling Show and David Morata will be right back. Stay with us. All right, we roll on here. Shilling Show, Turbo Tuesday edition of the program. Thank you for joining us weekdays from noon to 2. Is it 1 month from Election Day? I think it is. We continue with David Morata, the president of Morata Wealth Management. We're talking about socialism in continuing series here, looking backward on socialism. No such thing as self-sufficiency. Let's go to Elizabeth Warren, who had a very interesting speech some years back that was later cribbed inartfully by Barack Obama, but what did Elizabeth Warren have to say?
Yeah, Elizabeth Warren, this is her quote, and I can't quite say it in her same tone of voice, but I hear all of this, you know, well, this is class warfare, this is whatever. No, there is nobody in this country who got rich on their own. Nobody. You built a factory out there, good for you. But I want to be clear, you moved your goods to market on the roads the rest of us paid for. You hired workers the rest of us paid to educate. You were safe in your factory because of police forces and fire forces that the rest of us paid for. You didn't have to worry about marauding bands would come and seize everything at your factory and hire someone to protect against this because of the work the rest of us did. Now look, you built a factory and it turned into something terrific or a great idea. God bless. Keep a big hunk of it. But part of the underlying social contract is you take a hunk of that and pay it forward for the next kid who comes along.
So I got to ask you to repeat one line in there, the one that had the word marauding in it.
Yes. You didn't have to worry that marauding bands would come and seize everything at your factory.
So I'm thinking of the government that's now coming and seizing everything, and whether it's the local government, the state government, the federal government. Yeah, we do have to worry about that, and it's her.
We do. Yeah, She wants to put a tax on financial transactions, which I figured out would mean we basically wouldn't rebalance client portfolios.
We just stop looking at that, and because it's going to cost so much money to sell something to transact, we just stop the transactions.
Right. I mean, I'm in my articles at Murat on Money, I'm always railing on financial institutions that are charging, you know, even fractions of a percent of financial transactions or financial goods because it's simply too high. She wants to charge a 0.5% on every single financial transaction. That's 50 basis points. That is the difference between retiring on time and having to work another 3.5 years or retiring 25% less rich. The amount of money that would entail over a working and investing lifetime would be huge. It would be on every single person's 401k or IRA or anything else. You know, that kind of confiscation is on a level that I don't think we've ever even had proposed in the United States. And it would be incredibly dangerous. And she wants to do that on just about basically everything. You know, a 3% tax on people who make a lot of money, a 2% tax if you make a little bit less, not just on their income, but on their net worths, which is an incredible burden. I don't know how I would even value some of the things that I own. I have a business. What is my business worth? How would I pay 2% of that every single year to the government? Some items are just impossible to value. You value them once when you die, and sometimes it takes 5 years to settle an estate because they have to value everything in it, and it's very difficult.
It certainly is. And the other thing I noticed in those remarks, and I'm sure it wasn't just in your delivery, but it was the hostility, the underlying hostility towards the entire system, towards people that are successful, that try to be self-sufficient and make others with ability to be self-sufficient. Am I imagining that?
No, I don't think so. I think that's what people picked up when Obama talked about you didn't build that. I think that's what people in a Roanoke, Virginia campaign speech, I think that's what people pick up on. It's a disdain for commerce, and it's this idea of poking business to say, you know what, we're responsible for all of your successes, rather than just letting the success lie with the private sector person who built a business.
Let's go to some of the things that Elizabeth Warren referenced, and I guess the first one would be roads. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, actually, even before roads, I think it's worth commenting on her idea of a social contract.
Yes. The police chief mentioned that recently as well.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, one of the primary tenets of contract law is that both parties need to be uncoerced and need to join it voluntarily. So her comment about social contract, although I know it's a historical contract, has a historical context, but it's simply not true that there is some social contract of doing this. And if there was a social contract, it would really change things because you would be able to opt in and opt out of certain services or things rather than just having them mandated. And again, it's this cycle of government mandates things and is a monopoly of certain things, and then it uses that as a justification to seize more power, to take more things upon itself, to mandate more things. And the end of that is, as you suggested earlier, the government owns everything and runs everything, and they tell you what to do.
I mean, if the government can impose upon us, like the police chief and others, and say, well, hey, there's a social contract here, how come I can't impose a contract, let's say a moral contract, on the government? So certain things I consider immoral or some other way problematic, I'll just withhold my taxes for that, and I'll do it unilaterally because that's what you're doing to me.
Yeah, and we talked about this in probably our first talk, and that is that socialists assume that every rational person would agree with such a contract and would want to join the rules of their utopia. And that's how they justify the use of force to quell dissent, because only the mentally disturbed would disagree with stuff like this, and they just need to be put down.
Well, that's exactly where it's heading. David, let's go now to the roads, and then I want to talk about some of the other things she mentioned, because people bring this up all the time.
They do. Roads are often the first suggestion liberals use to illustrate the importance of government funding. And believe me, every libertarian would be ecstatic if governments were limited to spending money on infrastructure that we all use in common. But both Warren and Obama really didn't want to just simply support infrastructure. They wanted to soak the rich and spread the wealth around. So I think it's a disingenuous argument to point to roads. Current highway user fees, meaning gasoline taxes and tolls, pay about half the cost of building and maintaining the highway system. And the other half is actually, most of that is spent on trying to support the 80% of the roads that businesses don't use. Mm-hmm. So it's like the Postal Service. Some areas of common traffic are really easy to do, maybe about 20% of the roads. But 80% of the roads are out in rural areas where no business goes, and that's why they need government support. So it's really not fair to say that businesses aren't paying their fair share in order to support roads. They're actually paying more than their fair share. They're subsidizing all the rural roads that they don't use. Additionally, I really wouldn't mind if VDOT maintained my roads if they actually maintain them. But the roads in my neighborhood, which is, is actually a fairly well-trafficked neighborhood, mm-hmm. even, the roads in my neighborhood are filled with potholes, and then the group that get to repair them changes a pothole into a mogul, and now there's a big bump that I think is actually worth than the pothole, because the pothole you can glide over if you're going fast enough,
right.
but the mogul you just hit and it bumps. And every year I've complained to VDOT that the group they're getting is doing a terrible job and they should hold them accountable. And but people at VDOT have no incentive to try to hold people accountable or even go out and inspect the work that they're doing. We used to have a neighbor who was willing to plow our streets from snow as a free service mm-hmm. to the neighborhood, and VDOT shut that down and said that's illegal and threatened them with all kinds of lawsuits. So I actually think neighborhood associations would be able to support roads a lot better than VDOT does, because neighborhood associations would actually listen to the feedback and have an incentive to make sure the roads were well maintained.
All right, let's go to the phones here, 977-1070. That's the phone number. We welcome your comments, questions, or challenges for our guest, David Murata. We say hello to Keith. Hi, Keith.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm wondering if your guest, Mr. Murata, could discuss the possible intersection if we assert that we're becoming a more secular society and church attendance is dwindling. Does that vacuum which is created necessarily spawn a more cause for social justice and that? And is that perhaps why we're seeing more and more of this in terms of economic planning by government, et cetera, et cetera? And I will just, if that's clear enough, I'll just hang up and listen to your comments on the radio.
Keith, thank you very much. Very good question.
Yeah, in my research, we're going to talk about education, police, and fire. And in talking about police, I found it really interesting. There's a great TED Talk by Baltimore Police Lieutenant Colonel Melvin Russell, in which he suggests that we rely on the police much more than we should. And he basically says, you know, we call the police now to do all kinds of action we shouldn't. Kids are playing in the street. A dog poops on my lawn, all kinds of things. And then he says, you know, he says, listen, when I was a little boy, coming up in Baltimore, and listen, we played rough in the street. I ain't never seen a police come and break us up. You know who came? It was the elders.
Mm-hmm.
It was the parental figures in the community. It was those guardians. It was the village mentality. And I think the difficulty with even things like Hillary Clinton's It Takes a Village is that she assumes that the village is going to be government handouts and mandates put on someone else to pay for things. Rather than the village is actually going to be the societal structures that a lot of conservatives want to conserve and liberals want to tear down. So one of the difficulties is conservatives say, hey, you know, this stuff kind of worked in the past and maybe we should continue to support and encourage it. And liberals say, hey, it wasn't perfect, so tear it down. And that's a difference between the mentality of a utopian liberal view of that mankind is perfectible. And the tragic view that I think conservatives and libertarians agree with, and that is, you know, things aren't going to be perfect, but just because they're not perfect doesn't mean that they're not going to be okay. And having them be okay is not bad. The problem with government is government takes action, but it does not understand the complex ecosystem that is society. And governmental power is absolute because they can do whatever they want and they have the power to do it, to enforce it, but they don't have the wisdom to understand really distributed systems. And the distributed system of the economy is incredibly complex and prices are set perfectly by supply and demand or as perfectly as they can be. But government is more like, you know, imagine this is from another person. Imagine that you have omnipotent power over nature and you get stung by a bee and you say, well, this isn't perfect because I got stung by a bee. So you eliminate all bees.
Uh-oh.
There goes the complex ecosystem. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, you know, other plants and shrubs are dying and they can't reproduce, and the whole ecosystem is going to hell simply because you're trying to make it perfect, and nature is not perfect. Nature is messy. Well, human nature is messy too, and that's one of the differences between socialist thought and really the more accurate, tragic view of human nature.
And I want to put an exclamation point on Keith's comment, because it's happened right here in Charlottesville, where it was a few years ago that the Marxists in local city government decided they were going to impose what's called a rain tax, even though they didn't have to do that. They decided that would be a good thing. They could get their taxing power into churches. So one of the churches that does a lot of outreach and social work in the community, First Baptist Church over on Park Street, went before them and said, hey, if you tax us this extra $10,000, we're going to have to turn away people that we would be helping, and they're going to wind up at your doorstep. And this Moat Monster, Christian Zekos, who was on council at the time, said, well, then you'll just have to cut your salaries. But I think ultimately the government enjoys receiving more power and more people dependent on them, and they don't care.
I do think that there are incentives in government, and we're coming to an increasing understanding of the incentives in government to maintain their positions, to cover their asses, and to increase their power. And that government has just as many evil motives as businesses do, except they have no accountability because their customers are captive and really can't fire them.
Let's go to a quick break. On the other side, we complete this discussion with David Morata, 977-1070. Stay with us. All right, into the final segment with David Morata here on The Shilling Show, looking backward on socialism, no such thing as self-sufficiency. And Elizabeth Warren, we talked about roads. Let's go next to education, because this one fascinates me as a homeschool parent who has to still pay to support what I consider to be a corrosive and corruptive government schools. Let's look at the arguments here.
Yeah, Elizabeth Warren in her diatribe suggested that businesses hire workers the rest of us paid for. The gratitude, if there is any, should be from the workers who receive the education. You know, without that education, they wouldn't have been able to get such a great job. Mm-hmm. And the additional taxes to justify that education will be paid by the worker as they're taxed on their increased salary. You know, the business is already contributing a huge chunk of taxes to employ workers and payroll taxes, income taxes, Social Security, Medicare. And, you know, the government may have paid for my government-sponsored high school education. But, you know, a government high school education in this country really isn't worth that much. That's what we see from all of the statistics.
It may be less than worthless.
Yeah. And every implication of economic science suggests that this monopoly on education purchased by society costs more to society than it's actually worth. You know, my own high school happens to be currently in the top 1% mm-hmm. of 23,000 high schools. So it was a pretty good high school. I happen to know that there were teachers at that high school that should have been fired, and I talked to the administration as part mm-hmm. of the student leadership and was told, yeah, we know that he should be fired, but really we can't do anything about it because of this, that, and the other mm-hmm. of various laws. So even the top 1% of high schools in the country really could be improved. So over, you know, all the rest of them really should have a lot to talk about because they didn't even have the choice to go to my high school because mm-hmm. it wasn't in their neighborhood. And Elizabeth Warren really is against school choice. There's really no way of saying that she's for it. Her idea is you should be able to go to any high school within the district. But so that's, you know, any high school in a failing school district is still terrible.
Or where there's only one high school, like Charlottesville.
Right. And even if they could choose to go to one of the high schools, what would you do with all the high schools that no one chose to go to?
Mm-hmm.
You'd still have the same problem of you'd have to, you know, then you have to have a lottery system. And some people who bought houses in expensive neighborhoods just to go to the better school
right.
now would get lose the lottery and they'd have to go to a terrible school. You know, meanwhile, Elizabeth Warren's granddaughter attends the elite Harvard mm. Westlake School, where the annual first year costs are $46,750. You know, Barack Obama and Bill Clinton sent their children to the elite Sidwell Friends School, where the mm-hmm. annual costs are nearly $46,540. You know, the illiberal elite have choices. No one should be grateful for having their choices taken away from them.
And I think I find it so ironic that they're constantly talking about what they call the school to prison pipeline. And they're talking about government schools here, and yet these are the same people who refuse to allow people to have school choice. If you really thought the government schools were sending people in a pipeline to prison, you should be at the top of the cheerleaders advocating for school choice.
Many listeners may not know this, but my very first job was teaching at a community college. I love teaching. It's one of the passions of mine. I've basically turned every job I could possibly turn into a teaching job. I would love to run a school. It's been one of my lifelong desires to run a school, but I do not want to run a school in competition with a government monopoly because the financing doesn't work. It breaks people like me who would love to run a school. We'd love to have that public funding, because with that public funding, we know we could do much, much better for even the lowest income students. We could provide them with a great education and do much better at actually motivating and teaching, such that they were better prepared for life.
Let's talk about fire. We've got just under 2 minutes left, but I think it's an important one.
Yeah, the first fire brigade was the Union Fire Company. It was formed with the assistance of Benjamin Franklin in 1736. The United States did not have any government-run fire departments until around the time of the Civil War. So there's no question that we could have fire departments that were an all-volunteer fire department, or even a paid subscription fire department, or even a fire department that when they showed up, then you'd get the bill. There's all kinds of different models for doing that. And on a voluntary basis, entire neighborhoods could get together and have a fire department. We happen to have a volunteer fire department in the Crozet Volunteer Fire Department, and the government is always trying to shut them down, and they make it illegal for paid firefighters to volunteer in the Crozet Fire Department. And they do that because it's against labor laws that are set by the government as well, so they don't let that happen. And then there's no reason why government has to do that. And you might think, well, this is all just small town politics. These are the primary things that Elizabeth Warren lays out that are these must things that we need to be grateful for. And yet none of them are economically sound. They're not part of a free market. They're not part of a voluntary transaction. And we pay much, much more for them than we should. So if these are the best things that Elizabeth Warren has to offer for her argument of socialism and confiscating the greatest portions of wealth in this country, they're really bad arguments, and we should push against them. And again, to an economist, the delight is the idea that people seeking their own self-interest through voluntary transactions can do such a tremendous amount of good. Just the fact that we have bananas in the grocery store is a testament to free market economics. I don't know about other people, but when I go in the grocery store and I look at all that food from around the world, I am delighted with what the free market can produce. No government would ever do the kinds of things that a simple grocery store does in order to serve its clients.
And now they want to get the government involved in grocery stores. That's the latest push. It's called food justice. Topic for another day, David Murata. Thank you so much. He's online at muratahonmoney.com. What a great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
And by the way, these are being posted online. Latest one at shillingshow.com, and David's got them on his site as well. I've got Socialism, A Radical Denial of Human Nature. We just got that one up there a couple days ago, and you can go read what we had talked about last month. Share it with your friends. It is very important information, and for people who don't quite know how to answer those critical of our free enterprise system, free markets, capitalism, and self-sufficiency, this is great ammunition, so to speak.